Welcome to It's True or Is It? A podcast that mixes fact and fiction, then tries to sort them out again. Your hosts are Michael Pryor and George Ivanov. And welcome to episode one of It's True or Is It? A podcast that really gets into the difference between fact and fiction. My name is Michael Pryor.
And I'm George Ivanov.
Now, you might know me from such books, mostly for teenagers, such as the Laws of Magic series or the Ghost Town series.
And I'm probably best known for my interactive You Choose adventures, but I've written all sorts of other things for kids and teens as well.
That's excellent. And we are practicing writers. We've written many things for a long time, which really plays perfectly into the format of this podcast.
Indeed, it does.
And what we do here is we each present three stories based around our topic, and one of them is false.
But we try to make it sound as plausible as possible.
Exactly. We're trying to fool each other, basically. We'll read these stories out one at a time, take it in turns, and then at the end of the episode, we will reveal which stories were true and which were bogus.
Which is kind of what we do every day as writers, isn't it? We take bits of the truth and we embellish them and we do stuff to it to turn them into something that hopefully sounds plausible but is not necessarily so.
That's our job, George. And each episode will be following a particular topic. Mm-hmm. And the topic for today's episode is science, or the best way to know anything.
And it's a very broad topic, so it seemed like a good one to start off with.
Exactly. And we research our particular items and try to come up with interesting, intriguing, fascinating, extraordinary stories that we hope will interest you, whether they're true or not.
Indeed.
So let's get straight into it, George.
Okay.
I think you should go first.
All right, well, I'm going to give you a choice. My three topics are elements from the periodic table, states of matter, and radioactive bananas.
Can't go past radioactive bananas, George. Okay. So, like, just unpeel this one for me.
Oh, gosh. All right, you kind of threw me with the unpeel. I was not expecting that comment. Okay, so bananas are radioactive. It really is just as simple as that. So, in fact, is spinach, potatoes, oranges, and Brazil nuts.
Radioactive.
Now, by saying that bananas are radioactive, I'm not implying that they are radioactive enough to do you any damage. Just that they've got a certain amount of radioactivity to them.
If you see a banana, you don't get the warning.
No. They're not going to set off Geiger counters and all of this sort of stuff. Because, you know, let's see. Each banana can emit 0.01 millirems of radiation. That is a very, very small amount of radiation. For comparison, a chest X-ray delivers 10 millirems.
Hmm.
And that's not going to harm you, otherwise you wouldn't be having a chest X-ray. And a banana can emit up to 0.01. So it gives you that little bit of comparison.
All right.
So the radioactivity can get into plants in a couple of different ways. Firstly, by uptake. So the roots of the plants take in the radioactive materials from the soil. And there are a number of, you know, naturally occurring radioactive substances in soil, such as potassium and carbon and radium. And these get taken up into the plant. You can also get them via deposition, where radioactive particles in the air settle onto crops. Yep,
so far so good.
Yeah, so it just, they're radioactive. Not radioactive enough to kill you or even to do you any harm, because you would need to eat about 100 bananas to receive the same amount of radiation exposure as you get each day in the United States of America from natural radiation in the environment. So there is, you know, there's basically radiation everywhere, and I just picked a banana because it sounded Cool.
What is it that a joke is always better if you include a banana or a duck?
Maybe even both.
Oh. So your claim is
ducks are radioactive.
Oh, radioactive mutant duck.
If a duck ate a radioactive banana, would then that make the duck radioactive?
Look, Hollywood, here we come.
Mm.
So, George, your claim is that bananas are radioactive. And yep. You might have made that up.
It might be true. But I didn't.
Okay. Yes. Do we trust him, listeners?
Of course. Don't I have a very trustworthy sounding voice?
I will go straight into my first item, George. Unlike you, I have a distinct way of rolling them out, so I'm not going to offer you a choice. My first item is the origin of Velcro. Velcro, you know, mm-hmm. The sticky stuff that closes your shoes or the fly on your trousers or your tents. Now, a lot of people have fallen for the story that it was invented by NASA. And I'm here to tell you...
That's what I thought.
I'm here to tell you, not true.
Mm.
It was invented by a Swiss engineer called Georges de Mestral in the 1940s. And it was one of these sort of serendipitous things, a moment where something happened, someone noticed it, someone investigated it, and eventually came up with this brand new invention. So he was out walking with his dog in the countryside, and burrs, you know, those little seeds with hooks on them, got mm-hmm. caught in his clothing and in his dog's fur. But instead of just looking at it and swearing like most of us would have done, he was intrigued. Right? How were these things clinging so ferociously to clothing and dog fur? So he got collected some of the burrs and went to the microscope.
As you do.
He saw lots and lots of little hooks. Now, just in an aside for a bit of background colour, the dog's name was Milka, and Georges de Mestral was an electrical engineer by trade, sort of retired at this stage, and he lived in a castle.
He lived in a castle with a dog named Milka. Now, that is the part that's stretching credibility here. Like, I've been accepting everything up until now, but who names their dog Milka?
He was Swiss. Maybe it means something special in Swiss.
Yeah, I'm not convinced about that.
And he was an electrical engineer, and he had that sort of inquiring mind. And not just the inquiring mind, he had contacts. He had people in the industry. And he investigated the way that the little hooks worked, and he patented the hook and loop fastener that is almost universally known as Velcro. He patented it in 1951. It took 10 years for him to work out how to manufacture it in bulk. Like a lot of patent ideas, yeah, looks good on paper, but is it ever going to turn into a mass production item? Very few of them do. So Velcro comes from two French words, velours, which means velvet, and crochet, which means hook. So that the two parts of a Velcro closure, the matty part and then the hooky part. So it is true that the first major usage of it was in the aerospace industry, getting in and out of bulky spacesuits, but NASA didn't invent Velcro. In fact, it was an electrical engineer who lived in a castle.
It sounds plausible apart from Milka and the castle. That's what's giving me a little bit of doubt here. But apart from that, yeah, look, I can cope with the fact that NASA maybe didn't invent Velcro.
As a writer, I've got lots of writing workshops for young people and for grown-ups, and I always say that details are a writer's best friend, that details help convince people of this fictional landscape, these fictional characters. And that's sort of what we're doing here, isn't it? That we're including details to try to make our stories plausible.
Details that are just not working for me. Milka! Milka!
And have you ever heard of the notion of the red herring?
Yes.
So there might be details included just to distract you from the absolute murderer. I mean, from the absolute truth. All right. You got another one for us, George?
All right. So are we going to go with the periodic table or with the states of matter?
States of matter, please.
Okay. So there are a number of different states of matter. Solid, liquid, gas. They're the three everybody's heard of. There is, of course, plasma as well, which not as many people are aware of. And there are some others as well, such as the Bose-Einstein condensate. Don't ask me what that is. I have absolutely no idea.
I had a jar of it around here somewhere. I can't put my hands on it.
Yeah, but most things in the world can fit into either solid, liquid, or gas as a state.
Hmm.
Yeah. But it's not always as obvious as it might seem. Case in point, glass. Glass is hard, you can touch it, you can knock on it, it's solid, or so you think. It's not. Glass is not a solid, it is actually a liquid.
Tell me more, George.
It's just a really, really, really slow-moving liquid. It is actually... where is the actual term? It's actually called a supercooled liquid.
I see.
And so it appears solid, it feels solid, but it's actually a liquid. Now, there is evidence of this, and that is that over time, it does flow. So if you look at glass in old windows, such as medieval castles, that sort of thing, you will notice that the glass is thicker at the bottom than at the top.
So it's sort of run downhill.
Because it has run down. It has flowed down with gravity over a considerable amount of time. It does take an awfully long time for this to happen. I've got to point that out, awfully long time.
Your cathedrals, you're talking hundreds of years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
So there you go. Glass is a liquid, fact number two.
I'm trying to listen to that story and I'm trying to see through it. Like glass. You've not been transparent enough, George.
First the bananas, now the glass.
Yes, I'm just shattered here.
Oh, just move on. Give me your next one. Jeez.
I will go into my second item, and I'm leaving the planet Earth, and I'm going right out there into space, and I'm talking about exoplanets. You've heard of exoplanets?
Indeed I have, yes.
For the listeners out there, exoplanets are basically they're a planet outside our own solar system. They're orbiting another star, another sun way out there. The first detected exoplanet was in 1992, and since then over 5,000 exoplanets have been discovered, and all of them have been remarkable in all sorts of ways. And they're thinking that with the James Webb telescope out there, we're sure to find many, many more and many more unusual exoplanets. I'm going to take you to the exoplanet Kepler-16b, and it orbits a binary star, which is obviously Kepler-16. And Kepler-16 is 250 light years away from Earth. Now, Kepler-16b, this exoplanet, it's tiny, only about twice the size of our moon. But it has one amazing property. It orbits so close to the sun, Kepler-16a, that it actually skims the surface of the sun in its orbit. So it's sort of like this space-going snow plow. It plows through the outer layer of the star, Kepler-16a, and the outer surface is the corona. And it's been detected to be almost like a big ship throwing up a bow wave of sun material as it heads around in its orbit. And it's, well, the material is hot gas, about 500,000 degrees Celsius. And it's pretty spectacular from what we've been able to see. So it's the only one that's shown this sort of behavior. So it is unique. An exoplanet that is so close to its sun that it actually skims the surface.
Wouldn't it kind of, like, you know, be eaten away as it travels through the corona of...
The theory is that it was much bigger than it is now.
Right, okay.
And eventually it will either be sucked into the sun entirely or it will wear away.
Yeah, well, as it wears away, wouldn't it be more likely to then... be sucked into that. So it'll reach that point at some point where it'll just...
No return.
That sounds plausible.
Of course it does. I do this for a living.
Yeah. I like that one.
Right. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, the website dedicated totally to it that I found with the many, many distinguished scientists all contributing theories about Kepler-16b, well, they like it too.
That's good to know. That's good to know.
That's how true it is that scientists, people like it.
I'm going to give you my last one now, aren't I?
Please.
Okay. So you know about the periodic table, the elements on it. Now, some of the metals that are on that table are classified as water-reactive substances. That is, that they react in some way when they come into contact with water.
Right? Makes sense.
One particular group are the alkali metals. Right? So we've got lithium, sodium, potassium, rubidium, cesium, and francium.
Now, if I remember my periodic table, you've just sort of gone down then. You're going vertically down that group of alkaline metals.
Fabulous. So each of these metals will react if it comes into contact with water. Some more so than others.
Oh.
And that's what we're getting into here. So these metals induce a chemical reaction that creates hydrogen gas. This causes the water to be displaced, creating everything from fizzling at one end of the scale through to exploding at the other end of the scale. And then the metal itself will dissolve in the process. So lithium just fizzes a bit if you put it into water. Sodium also, potassium will actually ignite.
Ah.
So it'll fizzle and ignite a bit.
In water, it will... Yeah. Catch on fire in water.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. So it'll smoke and everything. You can go onto YouTube and watch the videos. They're quite cool. There's a lot of science lecturers at university who do these sort of live experiments for their students and then capture them on video and put them up for all to see. Oh, undoubtedly. And then you get to rubidium, which is so reactive that it's stored in a vacuum in a glass ampule, and you throw that into water and it'll explode. It will out and out, kaboom.
I'm guessing that they store it in a vacuum because the water vapour in the air might set
it
off.
I'm assuming so. Yeah. Hmm. We then come to the last one, which is francium. Now, the thing is that francium is rather radioactive.
Sure.
And very, very rare and very, very expensive. So university lecturers aren't in the habit of tossing bits of francium into water to show their students. In fact, no one has ever dropped it in water, so you won't see videos of that. But there are simulation videos of what scientists assume will happen if you threw a bit of francium into some water. And it pretty much just looks like a massive bomb has gone off because it is just so reactive. So there you go. That is my fact number three. The alkali metals on the periodic table each will react in water, varying degrees from fizzling to out and out exploding.
All right. I'm liking it. I mean, who doesn't like a good chemistry explosion?
I don't know. Who doesn't like a good chemistry explosion?
Oh, there's one guy somewhere. He sat in a bar in the corner and he used to mutter, "I hate chemistry explosions." I'm up to my third story, the one that in some ways I've been building up to.
Okay, hit me.
All right. I'm going to tell you about the scientist who killed more people than any other.
Ooh, I like the sound of this one already.
Now, when I say scientist, I actually, let's make that the person who's killed more people than any other. Mm-hmm. Here we go. I'm talking about Thomas Midgley Jr., an American mechanical and chemical engineer, born 1889 and died in 1944. Now, Midgley went to work at General Motors, and all of the motor industry at that time were having a bit of trouble with gasoline, with petrol in internal combustion engines because of when an engine reaches its maximum load, it made pinging noises or knocking noises that could damage the engine, the pistons in the engine. And Midgley went to work on additives that you could put into petrol to stop this knock or pinging. And after some experimenting, he discovered that adding tetraethyl lead, TEL, to petrol prevented this knocking in internal combustion engines. Now, there were other alternatives, but they were expensive. Adding tetraethyl lead was cheap as chips, and the company that he was working for at that time set to make a fortune. So the origin of leaded petrol came from Thomas Midgley Jr. Now, lead poisoning from leaded petrol is estimated to have killed over 100 million people until it was phased out in the 1980s, really. So he's got an enormous kill count.
Wow.
But wait, there's more.
There's more.
There's more. Because Thomas Midgley, after success and bonuses and making some money after inventing tetraethyl lead, he went on to work for the Frigidaire Company and helped invent Freon, one of the earliest chlorofluorocarbons, the chemicals that had an immense impact on the ozone layer, meaning the Earth's population suffered far more from the impact of UV radiation. That means, of course, more skin cancers, more cataracts, more deaths, all attributed to Thomas Midgley Jr. Now, they're hard to measure, but take your 100 million from tetraethyl lead, add another however many you want to, and Thomas Midgley is really racking up those numbers. Now, CFCs were eventually banned worldwide in 2010, but Midgley's kill count, that went on for some time after that. And a little bit more background about this character. Midgley contracted polio in 1940, very unfortunate, was severely affected to the extent he couldn't move around easily. But being inventor guy, he invented a contraption of ropes and pulleys so he could get out of bed by himself. Great idea. But in 1944, he was found dead, having been caught up and strangled by his own device as he tried to get out of bed.
I shouldn't laugh, but...
yeah, it's sort of ironic, isn't it?
Gosh, you know, for a moment there, I thought you were going to say that he died of lead poisoning and skin cancer, but, you know.
Back when they were inventing this tetraethyl lead and trying to sell it, he actually inhaled fumes from it just to show how harmless it was and got all the contracts. And then he got lead poisoning off stage and took some time to recover from it. They still went on to sell it in enormous numbers. Now, there's some evidence...
because it's cheaper.
Oh, cheaper and made people money. Now, there's some evidence that his death might have been suicide, that he organised the contraption to strangle him because he was just fed up with things, but we will never know. I'll just leave you with a quote from environmental historian J.R. McNeill, who said that Midgley had more adverse impact on the atmosphere than any other single organism in Earth's history.
Oh, goodness me. Yeah. That sounds absolutely plausible. The only thing I'm wondering about there is this same guy did CFCs and lead petrol. Really? Wow. But then I could believe that once you're on a good thing, you know.
Yeah, how can I top lead petrol?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. What's something that can make me lots of money but kill lots of people in the process? Yeah,
he won awards and everything.
No, I'm going to say that one's true.
Would you like me to review my three?
Yeah.
So very quickly. So the three stories I presented, first one was the origin of Velcro with George de Mestral.
Oh, Milka. Yes. I'm doubting that castle. One because of Milka.
The second one was the exoplanet that skims the surface of a star. And the third one was Thomas Midgley Jr., who killed lots of people. We'd
take Thomas Midgley out of the equation. I think that one's true. The exoplanet, I want it to be true, so I'm going to say that's true. Milka, I can't get past Milka. No, NASA invented Velcro.
I have to tell you, George, that I'm afraid you didn't get it right. Velcro was indeed invented by George de Mestral. Oh, he did have a dog. He did live in a castle.
All right, so it was the lead and the thing. It was two different people, wasn't it?
No. Thomas Midgley indeed invented leaded petrol and CFCs. The exoplanet was totally made up.
You did that well.
Ah, thank you. Thank you.
There was a lot of detail in that.
And as we said, that's the secret to it, isn't it? Mm. To make anything convincing, use detail.
Okay.
So regale me with yours.
All right, so exploding metals in water. Glass is a liquid and bananas are radioactive.
All right, again, process of elimination. I like bananas. I don't want them to be radioactive, but they could be. The glass can't be liquid. It's solid. It's hard. But then again, some liquids are hard. And the exploding alkali metals. Now, I can remember high school chemistry and the teacher putting a bit of sodium, probably, in a vat of water and seeing it split. Okay, so I still have to make a decision, don't I?
Yeah, that is the object of this. Stop procrastinating.
I can't say they're all true. No, they're all false. All right, so I'm going to say that the glass is false. Now, glass it can't be liquid.
You are correct. Glass is not a liquid.
Yay.
It is an amorphous solid.
Now, I reckon I've seen it and heard people say that it's a liquid.
It's a commonly held misconception. So that's why I chose it. So I didn't make this up. Right. It is a commonly held misconception. Uh-huh. And it's all part of that medieval glass windows being thicker at the bottom and thinner at the top. But that has got nothing to do with the state of glass. It's got everything to do with the manufacturing process. So these days, glass panes are completely the same thickness all the way through because they are created using the float glass method.
That's right.
So clear glass plates are made by pouring molten glass onto a pool of molten tin, resulting in a very flat, clear, uniform sheets. That method didn't used to exist. So there were a variety of different methods, but the one that resulted in the most discrepancy in the pane of glass was they would blow large bubbles of molten glass,
of course,
cut them off the blowpipe, splitting them open and flattening them out all while they are still hot and soft, then cutting the pieces into panes.
Yeah.
So there was a discrepancy from one side to the other, and it just made sense to put the heavier part on the bottom. So this didn't happen over time. It was like that right from the beginning.
Yeah.
The other, you know, giveaway is that we've got glass way older than those windows in terms of bottles and stuff like that. And that's still perfectly as it should be. It has not pulled at the bottom.
I think we might come across this again in our podcast series, these commonly held misconceptions. And if you roll them out to me, I say, oh, look, I've heard that. Yeah, that must be true.
That is the thing. You know, on the way here, I mentioned these three topics to my son, and he was like, oh, yeah, I know about the periodic table and the glass one. Yeah, I've heard about glass being a liquid.
Ah, so we can help people get on top of these misconceptions and become better human beings all around. That's the end of our first episode of our first season of It's True or Is It? And we'll be back very, very soon with our second episode. Now, George, second episode, I'm sure this one will appeal to you because it's history or the past and whatever's in it.
Ah, yes. Yeah, this is a topic close to my heart. I studied history high school at university and I've used it in my writing and I love researching various bits of history. Yeah,
look, I love history. So many good stories in history. Very, very useful for writers to draw on for inspiration and you come up with some interesting tweaks on what's happened in history and suddenly a story begins. Mm. So that's next episode. But before then, everybody out there needs to do something for us, George.
They need to subscribe to this podcast because we need listeners. That's the whole purpose of a podcast.
Indeed. So audience. Yeah. So subscribe, like, and comment too. Tell everybody about how wonderful this little podcast is, and we will be back next time. So until then, I'm Michael Pryor.
And I'm George Ivanov.
All the best, everybody. And that was the It's True or Is It podcast with Michael Pryor and George Ivanov. If you want to know more about Michael's books, podcasts and other projects, go to www.michaelpryor.com.au. And for George's books, writing and other projects, pop over to georgeivanoff.com.au. Now, we'll be back next time with more amazing facts, more amazing falsities, and remember, it's true, or is it? This podcast was recorded on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. We recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture.